We're talking food and nothing but this hour on the show. That bread on the table, it goes back to immigrants from Ukraine who brought their grains to the U.S. in the 19th century. The first loaves were serendipity.
Thank goodness somebody finally tasted the flour one day and made bread out of it and said, holy cow, this stuff is incredible.
Plus, a food writer hangs on to her meat-focused Korean culture, but going vegan challenges her identity.
Who am I if I don't get to eat these things that I associate so much with my Korean-ness?
And our reporter in London gives it to us straight.
Let's be honest, English cuisine isn't universally loved. But the full English doesn't need to be a complex cordon bleu experience to appreciate. It's food for the people.
The skinny on the Great British Fry Up. Grab your plate and tuck in. Today on the World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for spending some time with us this Thanksgiving. Our usual coverage is on pause today, and along with many of you, we're celebrating with food and drink, stories about food and drink. We start with the basics, bread, something that's part of nearly every culture. In the U.S., we grow most of our own wheat, but the roots of it start in Ukraine. The World's Bianca Hillier explains how every slice of American bread can be traced to the flat prairies above the Black Sea.
Back in the early 1870s, Mennonites left present-day Ukraine and headed to the United States.
As a group, as a village.
Fern Bartel is one of their direct descendants. She says they settled in Gosal, Kansas, because the land was similar to what they were used to back home.
It was the same climate and the same soil type, that kind of thing.
Soon, the group was farming the seeds they'd brought with them, including Turkey red wheat, a hard red winter wheat. It was unlike any other wheat being grown in the U.S. at the time. And Richard Sharman, who operates Palouse Colony Farm in Washington State, says the milling technology wasn't yet up for the job.
The millers didn't like those grains from Ukraine because they were hard on their equipment. But thank goodness somebody finally tasted the flour one day and made bread out of it and said, holy cow, this stuff is incredible.
Compared to the soft wheats grown in the U.S. at the time, Turkey red wheat has more protein, which makes for an overall better loaf of bread. Sharman says it also tastes better.
You know, it has a naturally nutty, sweet taste.
Over the years, milling technology improved. Ukrainian entrepreneurs brought in more shipments of Turkey red wheat.
And that's really how the modern American bread industry got started.
In the early 1900s, Turkey red wheat grew into one of the most popular wheat varieties. It was a major crop planted throughout the Great Plains. But
Turkey red, it had lots of problems.
Tim Riley is a fourth-generation farmer out in western Kansas. His family also moved to the States from the Black Sea region in the late 1800s. He says, originally, Turkey red didn't have disease-resistant properties and didn't yield a large enough crop. It was also tall and had a tendency to fall down at harvest time.
So when you grow Turkey red, you're taking some risk of not maybe having as good a crop or a crop at all.
That's where science came in handy. Over the years, Turkey red was crossbred with other wheat varieties to produce a whole bunch of higher-yielding, disease-resistant modern wheats.
With a few caveats, all the modern wheats that are grown today probably have some kind of Turkey red in its heritage.
In Gosal, Kansas, Fern Bartel puts it another way.
It's the great-grandmother of all the wheat that's out there now.
That legacy has been top of mind for Randy George since the war started in February. He owns Red Hen Baking in Vermont.
When the war started in Ukraine, that was, as a baker, the first thing I thought of, you know, oh, this is such an important place to us.
Today, relatively little pure Turkey red wheat is grown in the U.S., but Richard Sharman farms some in Washington. He sells it to local mills, who then market the flour to artisan bakers. Sharman says as the war continues in Ukraine, it's important that people know the backstory of U.S. wheat.
We have a great debt to Ukraine for the very food we eat and for the freedom that we've secured. And I hope that we can stand in solidarity with them in these times of such challenge.
Ukrainians themselves are proud of their history as Europe's breadbasket. The country's flag is blue on the top and yellow on the bottom to symbolize a clear sky above a healthy field of wheat. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Those of you making tonight's dinner might be enjoying a glass of wine as you cook. In the TV room, some football fans may have gotten a head start with a few beers, and the meal hasn't even been served. Tomorrow, you or your guests may wake up saying, "I will never drink like that again." Yeah, as long as humans have been consuming alcohol, there have been hangovers, maybe even earlier than that. How? Well, our next guest explains. Shaughnessy Bishop Stahl is the author of Hungover, The Morning After, and One Man's Quest for the Cure. I asked him about certain gemstones that are said to tame a headache after a bender, and whether there's anything to that.
Most old wives' tales have some piece of science in them that we might look on as magic now, but there's, you know, the line between magic and science has been thin throughout human history, and especially when it comes to anything to do with alcohol.
So what's the deal with amethyst?
It's one of these things where there's been a lot of broken telephone over the centuries or millennia.
By that you mean kind of misinformation that gets passed on and gets completely morphed in the process.
It gets morphed, very much so. There are, through the dozen or so years that I was researching the history of hangovers and hangover cures, I would come across references to amethyst quite often. And I actually did one hangover experiment where I used frankincense, myrrh, and gold, because there are some aspects of gold that are suggested to ward off the ill effects of alcohol, let's say.
How did that experiment work out for you?
Not very well. Most of my experiments did not work out very well for me. There used to be a good business in Victorian England where the chimney sweeps would get all the soot from inside the chimneys and sell them around Yuletide for people to put in their drinks in milk before they drank alcohol. It was supposed to purify them and stop their hangovers. It just made my tongue purple and made me very sick.
I was going to say it made the milk black.
Yeah, the frankincense is actually one that I still use in some of my tonics because it has extremely powerful anti-inflammatory properties.
I mean, is there a historical hangover cure you've uncovered that is actually based in science?
Oh, absolutely. Most of them, to tell you the truth. And it's hard to say if they're based in science or if science is based on them. So hangovers are prehistoric insofar as they existed before human history did.
Are you saying basically the hangover started as soon as humans discovered how to make alcohol?
Well, perhaps before so. Even when the apes and the bees would come across fermented fruit and fly around real weird and wake up not feeling too well. The hangovers may pre-exist humans. The first hangovers that we see recorded are in biblical texts or ancient scriptures. And in almost every one of those, there are references to things that to this day have scientific validity. One quick example, eggs of birds, fowl eggs, chicken eggs, have always been a part of breakfast. I never really stopped to think of why. You know, why is this a universality? One of the properties of a fowl egg or a chicken egg is something that is an amino acid called N-acetyl-L-cysteine. It is the main ingredient in the hangover concoction that I finally, after a dozen years of testing everything and trying everything, have settled upon.
Shaughnessy, Bishop Stahl's book is called Hungover, The Morning After and One Man's Quest for the Cure, helping us understand the history of and cures for the dreaded hangover. Shaughnessy, I will not thank you in moderation, though. Thank you very much. It was a great conversation.
It was nice to talk to you, Marco.
Thanksgiving and the anticipation of a home-cooked meal. Growing in popularity, though, is dining out on the holiday. You might not be able to match your grandma's pumpkin pie. On the other hand, no dishes. So how far would you travel for a good meal? New York, Paris, or even farther to a place that is, relatively speaking, off the map? Reporter Emily Hovick went to the High Arctic. The restaurant she visited does not serve turkey and mashed potatoes. Get ready for reindeer steak and seal carpaccio.
We're in the kitchen of restaurant Polfararen.
Two reindeer ribs and risotto.
This place offers Nordic fine dining with hints of Japanese influence.
And these are coming right up.
Okay.
A small, high-quality menu, changing with the seasons.
Cloudberry creme caramel.
Every meal beautifully plated.
A red bean risotto with miso marinated cod.
It's the kind of place you'd visit in a major metro. But we're in the Norwegian archipelago of Svalbard, in the high Arctic, surrounded by glaciers and permafrost.
Amazing.
Welcome to Longyearbyen, the world's northernmost permanent settlement, known for polar bears and research facilities. Today, it's a tourist destination with about 17 restaurants and a dozen hotels. But a few decades ago,
there was no restaurants.
Steve Torgerson moved here with his family at the age of 15, when it was a coal mining town.
There was living in the coal company's house. There was eating in the coal company's canteen. And it was in 1979. That was the first time we could go another place to eat than the canteen.
That was Huset, the first restaurant in Svalbard. Torgerson left high school to work there in 1990. The food scene in Longyearbyen was growing, slowly.
In 1993, Svalbard Crew and Motel opened.
More restaurants followed. Today, Torgerson himself owns a couple. One of them is Gruvelagera, offering a fine dining experience with a spotlight on the past.
That people get more information and more knowledge about the place and the history.
And these days, Longyearbyen holds a powerful pull for young chefs. Chefs like Josh Wing at restaurant Pulfararen.
Yeah, I've been up here for about 6 years.
Wing is from Montana. His first job up here was at Huset, where he learned about Norwegian fine dining.
The simplicity, the quality of ingredients, and focus you put on what you're plating was very, very, like, eye-opening to me.
In 2019, Wing became the head chef at restaurant Pulfararen. And he says providing a high-quality gastronomical experience at 78 degrees north comes with challenges.
We usually run with a very small menu.
Many products have to be ordered from mainland Norway 2 weeks ahead of time. Then
it takes about 3 days to get my product up on a boat. So with light leafy vegetables and like kale, sometimes don't really make that journey very well.
Wing serves as many local items as possible, like reindeer, cod, and ptarmigan, which is an alpine game bird.
This year I ordered 5 reindeer from one of the trappers that we work with. The ptarmigan I usually get from friends that are hunting locally in town.
The fish he catches himself.
Hi, and welcome to the extreme north.
Andreas Vistad is a Norwegian restaurateur, food writer, and TV host. He's traveled to Longyearbyen many times.
We've shot several episodes of my television series, New Scandinavian Cooking, there.
The reasons for the rise of Longyearbyen's food culture are complex. To start, Vistad says because of the tax regime, hotels and restaurants like Huset could import fine wines cheaply.
Some of these hotels built really world-class wine cellars where you could get well-matured bottles of wine at a price unlike anywhere else in the world.
Vistad says there's also a trend of young, ambitious chefs from Scandinavia taking a couple years to work in Svalbard. Then there's another, more practical explanation. Visitors to Svalbard include researchers, extreme campers, and students. But it's also become a high-end tourist destination.
When you're traveling on such an adventure, you really want everything to be an adventure, even the dinner.
And Vistad says the food simply can't be separated from the place.
It is an almost magical experience to be able to have a meal and walk out into the cold and the snow, but it's still bright as in the middle of the day, even though it's midnight. It creates a kick of euphoria.
And for chefs like Josh Wing and Steve Torgerson, that's a euphoria that they're working to create for each visitor with every single menu. For The World, I'm Emily Havik.
Coming up, it's not only the Thanksgiving meal that's gotten more expensive. The cost of an English breakfast is also up. Blood sausage, anyone? You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The Thanksgiving meal is uniquely American. Canada's Thanksgiving in October follows a turkey, gravy, potatoes formula, which is really a variation on Quebecois poutine, if you think about it. Every country has a dish it's famous for, even if it might be hard to explain why. In England, that meal is breakfast. We recently sent reporter Leo Hornack into the wilds of London, and this is what he found.
There's a ritual that Londoners are familiar with. On a difficult morning, or after a heavy night, a sacred go-to ceremony, the full English breakfast.
A full English is a meal. It's not a snack. It's divine. That is really divine.
And to do that ceremony justice, you need to come to one of its temples, a traditional London breakfast cafe, known as a CAF. A place like this.
As it happens, I was going to wait for you and I thought we'd have a breakfast together, so I haven't had anything yet.
The Polo Cafe by Liverpool Street Station. This high priest of morning feasts is owner Philip Inzani. His great aunt opened the place in the 1950s, and Philip's been offering full English breakfast to tired and hungry Londoners all his life.
Well, it's our best-selling dish. So we've got, I don't know, about 40, 48 dishes on the menu, and it's one of our best sellers.
Oh, and the tea has just arrived. Fantastic. Thank you.
It's got to be a cup of tea in there. Yeah.
Let's be honest, English cuisine isn't universally loved. And I'm not going to convince you any different with this radio piece. But the full English doesn't need to be a complex cordon bleu experience to appreciate. It's food for the people. Simple enough to make at home, but rich enough for a true master like Philip to raise to an art form. If you're on a diet, this is your trigger warning. You may want to turn away from the radio now.
Yeah, so baked beans, standard baked beans. So the mushrooms, we roast our own mushrooms. So they're roasted with thyme, salt and pepper, and a little bit of garlic. Tomato, roasted tomato.
That's your vegetables taken care of. On to meat, or meats.
A sausage, that's a Cumberland sausage. So it's very strong with parsley. It's got a lot of herbs in it. Fried egg, that is the traditional. The bacon is griddled. Toast, that sourdough. And then last, but by no means least, you've got the black pudding there, hidden in between the toast.
Black pudding, that's a savoury item. Basically a blood sausage.
So it's made now with dried blood. They put suet, they put fat, they put breadcrumbs in there and things like that. So I quite like it myself, but I can understand why a lot of people wouldn't prefer a hash brown.
The whole thing is presented on a single plate. The beans nestled against the eggs and sausage. The toast already soaking up the fat from the bacon. All for £10.50, about $12. Like Philip said, this is a meal, not a snack. A carnival of fried food. There's a reason cafes like Philip's are also called greasy spoons. All around us, his regulars are settling in, placing orders, or hunched over plates and steaming cups of tea.
Can we do a full English? Yeah, with black pudding and give him hash brown on the side, yeah?
No one's quite sure of the origins of the full English as a complete dish. Possibly the 18th century, possibly even further back. And throughout Ireland and the British Isles, there are regional variations on this tradition. The Welsh breakfast has its own bread. The Irish, a different kind of pudding. In Scotland, you might find a tempting piece of haggis on the plate. But part of this grand tradition of the CAFs and their breakfasts is changing, just like so much else.
And what about the cost of actually producing one of these amazing full English breakfasts?
Well, it's obviously gone one way and it's gone up hugely, unfortunately. My suppliers that I've worked with for the last sort of 11 years, they're in the same dilemma as, you know, pretty much everyone at the moment, facing rising raw ingredient costs, rising fuel, etc.
Brexit, COVID, and now the war in Ukraine. The cost of daily life in Britain is rising for many reasons. And let's face it, for Philip's customers, a full English breakfast is not a good way to tighten your belt, financially or gastronomically. And that's beginning to put the tradition under threat. Philip's been getting calls from other London CAF owners.
Literally last week, I was speaking to a pretty close friend of mine who phoned me up. The bottom line is that he's had to close his unit after 15, 16 years. He knew the business, but wasn't making any money and therefore couldn't continue operating.
For now, it's time for Londoners like me to do our bit and support our local CAFs while they're still here. Not the worst assignment. My order's just arrived.
So get you another cup of tea.
Oh, I would love that. Yeah, yeah, cheers, thanks. All right, so here we go. Here's the full English. Tools of the trade ready. Delicious. Amazing. Long live the full English.
For the world in London, I'm Leo Hornack.
Taking the mick out of English cuisine. The truth is, Britain has produced some of the world's great chefs. We lost one of them earlier this year, journalist and author Diana Kennedy. Her focus was not English cooking, though. She spent decades studying, cooking, and writing about traditional Mexican cuisine. Kennedy even settled in the Mexican state of Michoacán.
I really think the entire country and people of Mexico will forever be indebted to her efforts.
Patty Hinich is from Mexico City, well known as a chef, author, and host of Patty's Mexican Table. She first met Diana Kennedy while working on another cooking show about 25 years ago. Hinich says Kennedy had the whole production crew over for breakfast.
And she welcomed us with a Mexican torta. She had her homemade refried beans, homemade pickled jalapenos, and homemade guacamole. And it was probably the best torta I've ever eaten.
Hinich was impressed with the food and Kennedy's love for Mexico.
I was in awe. You know, her enthusiasm, her love for the country, her thorough and really rigorous research.
All that knowledge was a result of years of traveling throughout Mexico.
Muchas personas pensaban que ponía la pepita pelada en sus moles. Pero aquí no.
You can watch Kennedy on YouTube. She is totally focused on picking up traditional techniques from home cooks and talking to people at local markets about their region's ingredients.
Y este chile, ¿cómo se llama aquí?
Chile de uña de pico.
Uña de pico. Es el árbol, chile de árbol.
Diana Kennedy's work earned her high acclaim. She published 9 cookbooks, won 4 James Beard Awards, and received an Order of the Aztec Eagle from the Mexican government, the highest decoration awarded to foreigners for cultivating the cuisine and tourism of Mexico. Over the years, a few critics have questioned the ethics of a white British woman becoming one of the major faces of Mexican cuisine. Patty Hinich has heard those comments and does not think they're fair.
She had the utmost respect to anything Mexican, and she credited all of the people that worked with her and that were the sources of her recipes and her food. I don't know any Mexican chef that doesn't admire her work.
Diana Kennedy leaves behind a whole host of fans, not to mention her legacy of celebrating and sharing with the world Mexican food. She was 99 when she died in July. More coming up on this Thanksgiving Day edition of the show. You're listening to The World. It looks like bacon. It tastes like bacon.
It's got a really crunchy, nice crispy, which is what I wanted. I wanted crispy bacon.
Maybe it's too much like bacon, which is why pork producers in France say you can't legally call it that. Plus, an alternative to putting your Christmas tree on the curb when the holidays are over, eat it. That's still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. We're back with this special edition of the show and stories from the culinary world. In Kazakhstan, the former Soviet Republic in Central Asia, there are, of course, Kazakhs, Russians, and Koreans. In the 1930s, Soviet leader Joseph Stalin deported thousands of ethnic Koreans from the far east of the Soviet Union and sent them by train to Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. Those relocated Koreans kept their culinary traditions, just adapted to local ingredients and tastes. It became the distinct food of the Koryo Saram. From the Kazakh city of Almaty, the world's Duri Buscarin has more.
The tall, sunlit warehouse of the Green Bazaar is where the foodways of Almaty converge. Turkish pickles, dried fruit and nuts from the hillsides of Tajikistan, cheese and bread made by Uzbek chefs. And on the far left side is a row of tables piled high with brightly colored marinated foods. In Russian, Vera Nikolaevna explains each one while handing out samples. Spicy cucumbers, chilled mushrooms, marinated fish, all of the side dishes traditionally served with Korean food. Nikolaevna shows me a red chili powder known as gochugaro, a staple in Korean households. A local variety is grown and processed in Uzbekistan, like so many other fruits and veggies that make the Korean cuisine of Central Asia unique. When Stalin deported nearly 200,000 ethnic Koreans to Central Asia in 1937, they brought with them seeds for specific types of red beans, hot peppers, and corn used in breads made for the holidays, and they were forced to farm rice.
The cuisine, the Koryo Saram cuisine, is very different than from South Korean.
German Kim directs the Institute for Asian Studies at Al-Farabi University in Almaty and is one of the world's leading scholars of the Koryo Saram.
I remember from my childhood that we have eaten rice, but rice which we put in the cold water.
Cold rice eaten with every meal, a dish that's no longer served in South Korea.
As I know, in the old, old time, in the ancient time, in all Korean peninsula, all people have eaten this way. And then the culture of the cuisine and the culture of the meals changed.
In Kazakhstan, local ingredients also influenced Koryo Saram cooking. Fish from the sea were replaced with local freshwater fish. New types of mushrooms were borrowed from Chinese cuisine. And in the absence of daikon radish, Korean cooks invented a now popular carrot salad, its bright orange hues attracting Kazakh and Korean shoppers alike. A Korean shopkeeper named Eugenia, who asks us only to use her first name to protect her sales, says she's seen a boom in customers in recent years, which she attributes to Kazakhstan's love for K-pop and South Korean dramas. We used to have just four salads, she says, standing behind a display of about 15 types of prepared food. Then her customers started to ask for specific things. Take kimbap, she says, pointing to long rolls of ham, fish cake, and pickled radish wrapped in vinegar rice and seaweed. We never used to sell this, but people saw it on TV shows and started asking for it. So we started to make it, she says. Some Koryo Saram chefs see cooking as a chance to reconnect with their heritage. 34-year-old Marina Choi remembers how her family would get together every winter, right before Korean New Year, to make batches and batches of kimchi. We salt the kimchi for the coming year, sometimes 200 to 300 kilograms at once, she says. If you average it out, that's more than 500 pounds of cabbage. It's a staple tradition, she says, because the family can bond and spend time together. Choi says there are 18 ingredients in her kimchi, peppers, ginger, and about a dozen spices. She developed this age-old recipe into a profitable business known as Choi Food. On the label is an illustration of her wearing a traditional hanbok, a Korean style of dress. I've always had a motto to make everything with love, as if you're making it for yourself, she says. That's why people like it. For the world, I'm Dari Buscarin, in Almaty, Kazakhstan.
Here's another way Korean food has been adapted, vegan Korean. Joanne Lee Molinaro grew up in the States in an immigrant household that was not vegetarian. Her parents were born in what is now North Korea. Through cooking, Molinaro grew to better understand her family and their story. It led the trial attorney to blog about it, write cookbooks about it, and raked her in 3 million plus followers on TikTok. She calls it all a happy accident.
I actually started my food blog in 2016, which is when I decided to go plant-based. But at that time, it was your typical food blog, just a catalog of recipes, Instagram, Facebook. And in 2020, I started a TikTok account, and it was a happy accident. I did not do so with the intent of creating content. I did it really just to watch other people create content and be entertained or provoked to think about things. But as often happens, I was inspired and I started posting videos of myself creating food. But I shared my thoughts, I shared stories, I shared kind of my views on the political climate that was going on outside my window, as well as the pandemic.
So I got to say, I go to my H Mart in my neighborhood, and it is impressive, the various cuts of beef and pork and delicate slices or marinating in a fiery gochujang paste. You have not been a lifelong vegan. What was the hardest part about ditching meat?
I grew up eating, like you said, cuts of meat and pork. That used to be my favorite food. So not getting to eat those things was, sure, a little bit hard. But much harder was sort of my grappling with my cultural identity. Who am I if I don't get to eat these things that I associate so much with my Koreanness? And navigating that path was much harder, but also ultimately far more fulfilling.
Well, a lot of what you do on your TikTok, in your book, The Korean Vegan, is connecting to family. I mean, that is in the title of your book, Amma's Kitchen. Who is Amma, and how does cooking for you connect back to family?
Amma means mom or mother in Korean, and cooking with my mother or with recipes from my mother or any of the kind of motherly influences in my life, what it does is it transports me to a place back in my childhood when I was relying on my mother and my aunts and my grandmothers for food. But what it also does is it transports them back to Korea. They live in the United States right now. So it's a transportive, nostalgic, and incredibly intimate experience for me and my mother, as well as the other women in my family.
I mean, I get a sense that it's really absorbing because on your TikTok sometimes you'll be cooking and you don't even talk about the process of the food that you're making. You're talking about family. I mean, your dad in particular, whom you've had an up and down relationship with. Here's a bit from one recent TikTok video you posted.
This is kwabaegi. It's a Korean donut. It's also my dad's favorite donut. Y'all are probably wondering, why does Joanne talk about her dad all the time? And it's because my dad is now in his late 70s, and I don't know how much time I have left with him. And I feel like I wasted so much of my life not being the best daughter to him.
Oh, that's so confessional. I mean, both your parents are immigrants from the Korean Peninsula. Tell us about your dad, Joanne, and his story, because it seems to be a driving force in what you cook and why.
It is definitely a driving force in so much of my content. So much of my childhood was me viewing him as the typical Korean dad, not affectionate, doesn't talk to me, only views me as a report card. How unfortunate is that, that I sort of decided to take that and never really dig for why is he like that? I ultimately discovered a few years ago when I asked my father to share his story with me that his own father had been incredibly abusive with him. And perhaps a lot of the reason he's so withdrawn and aloof from everyone, not just me, is a defense mechanism and a coping mechanism for the pain. And seeing him that way opened this door that I had previously ignored.
Has cooking brought you closer to him?
Absolutely, because he sees how much joy it brings me to feed him. And how wonderful is that? Because when he was raising us as kids, my mom was working full-time as a nurse, he often had to make naengmyeon and jjajangmyeon and ramyeon for us. And now I get to return that favor. And so when I make him naengmyeon or when I make him jjajangmyeon from scratch, which is not something that's easy to do.
And what is that briefly?
Jjajangmyeon is black soybean noodles, and naengmyeon is a cold buckwheat noodle. These are his favorite dishes, and I present them to him. He knows that I'm sitting there waiting for his evaluation, his report card, and that's not only really fun, but it makes us so much closer.
That's the kind of report card you're looking for, aren't you?
Exactly.
So let's talk about the food. I want to ask you about one main course then, a noodle dish that you say you eat at any special occasion, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, whenever you can. Korean glass noodles with julienne vegetables. Is this a family recipe?
Yes. So this is japchae. It's made with sweet potato glass noodles or vermicelli. And it is absolutely the one dish that I always ask my mom to make for my birthday. Oh, what do you want me to make for your birthday? Japchae. It's like there's no hesitation. I ask for it every single year. We often also have it on the Thanksgiving or Christmas table. And as I mentioned in the book, it can be a little labor intensive because you're supposed to saute and stir fry each of the vegetables separately. And so that's why it's a special occasion dish.
And do you have any tips on julienning so many vegetables without shredding your fingers?
You know, practice makes perfect. That's, you know, that's what I tell my husband. My husband is a concert pianist, so he takes, you know, cutting very seriously because he doesn't want to injure his hands or cut his fingers, obviously. And sometimes he'll bust out a fork when chopping up vegetables. And I'm like, that's fine, babe. You do what you need to do, with the idea that the more he does this and the more comfortable and confident he gets, I know he'll get faster.
The recipe is for Korean glass noodles. We have a link to it at theworld.org. Joanne Lee Molinaro, thank you very much. Continue making those videos and best of luck with the Korean Vegan Cookbook.
Thank you so much, Marco.
That fork trick works, by the way. Pierce a carrot, for example, with a fork, run your knife through the tines, and repeat on the bias. Save your fingers. Staying with our theme of people and food migrating long distances, we take you now to a small town in Vermont, Randolph, population 5,000. It's home to the winner of this year's James Beard Award for Best Chef in the Northeast, an accolade the honoree had never heard about growing up on a rice farm in northern Thailand. Michaela Lafrak from Vermont Public Radio has our story.
In an old blue Victorian mansion on a hill is Sop, a Thai restaurant run by Nisachung Morgan and her husband Steve. They've offered to cook me up a couple dishes before the lunch rush hits.
What do you want to make, honey?
What do you want to eat? I want to cook for you. Eat.
Oh, I don't know.
You can look. Give her menu.
I start looking over the menu. Most of the dishes you'd find at a typical Thai restaurant in the U.S. were popularized in Bangkok, like pad Thai. Nisachung Morgan, who goes by Rung, is from the northeast region called Isan.
We eat food really different from Bangkok, you know. Mm. Bangkok use coconut, you know, but we don't use coconut too much.
Only Isan is rural, hot. Its cuisine often features fermented and pickled vegetables and meat, epic spice levels, courtesy of chilies, and lots of sticky rice. Rung picks out one of her favorite menu items to whip up, an herbaceous chicken soup called Tom Yum Gai Isan. The broth is somehow both sour and sweet. It's flavored with the kitchen's holy trinity of lemongrass, kefir lime, and galangal, a ginger-like root. I taste some and swoon.
Rung, so good. I'm so good. Thank you.
Rung and Steve Morgan started the restaurant together as a way to share their love of cooking. Steve worked as a chef and cooking instructor. The two met online about a decade ago on the dating site Match.
And so after Skyping for about 6-7 months, I got a ticket to Savannakhet Airport, which is the big airport in Bangkok. And Rung met me there with bags of mangosteen and lum yai and long kong.
Steve started falling for the food in Isan at the same time he was falling for Rung. Their visit went well, and after a couple more, Rung and Steve got married, and she moved with her daughter to Vermont. She got a job cleaning rooms, and at night, she'd tell Steve about her dreams.
And she kept saying to me, you know, I don't want to keep cleaning rooms, I want to have a restaurant.
I tell him, I want to open Thai restaurant. I want to open Thai restaurant.
So they took the leap. They rented a space and selected a Thai word for their new restaurant's name, Sop. Steve first heard the word on one of their visits to Isan.
It means delicious. So when we went there and everybody was sitting around the table with the sticky rice, going, Sop, Sap Lai De.
Sop, sap, maple syrup, you get it. They decorated their restaurant with a quirky mix of Thai and Vermont decor. Red plaid curtains here, Buddhist statues there. Rung wanted to include some well-known Thai dishes on the menu to attract customers, but Steve pushed to stick to their vision.
I knew if she cooked food like it was from home, and we paired it with local beer, local cider, people would drive for it.
There was one dish they could not agree on, pad Thai.
We fought a little bit about, I was like, we're not going to have pad Thai on the menu. But people expect it. They come
people
to a Thai restaurant.
People love pad Thai, no? People love pad Thai.
Whatever she's doing seems to be working. And even though Vermont and Thailand are so different, she says she's not homesick. What she is busy. Lunch customers are about to come in, so I get the rest of my food to go. For the World, I'm Michaela Lafrak in Vermont.
Some of my favorite food is Asian, Thai, Vietnamese, Japanese, Chinese. Salty soy sauce, a common element running through them all. All food would be pretty boring without salt, but too much sodium is not good for our health. Ais Sato is with Kirin Holdings, a Japanese beverage company, selling an alternative. She said in a video featured on Taiwan Plus News that cutting out salt would mean eating bland food. So her company, of course, has a solution. They teamed up with researchers to invent electric chopsticks that they say make food taste saltier than it actually is. The chopsticks look like chopsticks, but they're attached by a cord to a small computer you wear on your wrist, kind of like a giant smartwatch. Meiji University researcher Home Miyashita explains, also in a video on Taiwan Plus News. He says the device uses electricity to attract sodium ions in the food to the chopsticks, and then slightly alters those ions. So when you raise the chopsticks to your mouth with a bite of food, it all tastes saltier. If you want to run your own test on it to see if it actually works, you'll have to wait a bit. The team behind the salty chopsticks say they hope to have them available for purchase next year. Thanksgiving centers around the turkey. Some of you may feel the dinner's incomplete without a ham. But consider the vegetarians. In France, they'd love more consideration. From Paris, Rebecca Rossman wades into the French flesh wars.
It ain't easy being vegan in France.
You have so much social pressure to just stick with meat on every single meal.
That's 35-year-old Nicolas Schweitzer. A vegan for about a year now, Schweitzer is also the co-founder of La Vie, a plant-based food startup on a mission to start a bacon revolution of sorts.
I'll show you quickly the lab.
Schweitzer takes me into a white-walled fluorescent light lab so I can taste La Vie's two flagship products, streaky American-style bacon and French lardon.
Which I guess in the U.S. you would call maybe bacon bites or pancetta.
Yeah, very similar to pancetta. Mm.
We are convinced that animal fat is a big part of what makes animal meat so delicious.
Which is why they've spent years recreating that fatty layer using plant-based proteins.
It's got a really crunchy, nice crispy, which is what I wanted. I wanted crispy bacon. It's got the exact texture. And then this fat layer, it's got like the sort of gelatinous
juiciness
of fat.
In other words, it's pretty close to the real thing. But this feat has gotten La Vie into trouble with France's pork lobby, known as Inapork.
As you can imagine, the pork lobby wasn't a big fan of all the fuzz around the product and the fact that it was as good as pork and everything.
Earlier this year, Inapork served La Vie with a formal notice for unfair competition for its veggie lardon, which they said risked, quote, deceiving customers into thinking they were buying meat lardon. The pork lobby also said La Vie's advertising violated the terms of a forthcoming law. That law bans plant-based food manufacturers from using words traditionally associated with meat products on their labels, like sausage, steak, and bacon. In response, La Vie took out a full-page ad in the newspaper Le Parisien.
We told them, all right, thank you so much for the compliment. We actually think that your product tastes a bit too close from our products. Could you please change your recipe?
Over the summer, the Supreme Court agreed to put the label law, which was set to take effect this October, on hold. La Vie hopes the law will at least be modified. Inapork declined to comment, saying it didn't want to speak publicly about an ongoing case. Luckily, some of the pork butchers here at the former Layard Market near Rue Montorgueil in central Paris aren't as tight-lipped. Laura Spencer is a butcher at Les Terroirs d'Avenir, which sells local organic produce, cheeses, meats, and other products. She calls the whole debacle silly.
This all gets a little bit too far-fetched, and it's just trying to create an even bigger gap between those who do eat meat and those who don't eat meat.
But she also says she's not a fan of plant-based meat alternatives.
You can do so many other things with vegetables and get the same results without having to recreate false burgers and false sausages and stuff like that.
If you're a vegetarian because you don't like meat, that's great, good for you.
But Schweitzer thinks many vegans, like him, love the taste of meat.
To have an option to retrieve all the pleasure that you get from meat, from an organoleptic perspective, from a taste perspective, but without all those negative impacts, is amazing.
Because of that, he hopes that eventually the meat industry will be phased out entirely, along with coal and other industries that are damaging for the environment. He says it's time for our society to transition to something that's more sustainable. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
If you've been with us for the hour today, you remember we began with a story about the origins of America's wheat, a hardscrabble but flavorful grain known as turkey red that gives a lot of today's bread its flavor. We conclude with another story from Bianca Hillier. She's partial to flavorful ingredients, even if they are a bit, in this case, chewy. like seriously chewy. Here's Bianca.
When I first heard about eating a Christmas tree, I had one main question. Does it taste like it smells? I asked Julia Georgialis, a food writer and baker in London.
We always think that they're going to taste like car air freshener, like cleaning products, because that's what we associate pine, fir, and spruce with.
Thankfully, that's not the case. She says each of these trees has a unique taste.
Pine's quite subtle and quite warming in a way. Fir is really grassy, and spruce has a similar flavor profile to vanilla.
Georgialis knows all of this because since 2015, she's been hosting pop-up Christmas tree dinners. As you can imagine, there was a lot of trial and error before any dish made the menu.
Initially, we tried to deep fry fir needles and stuff, and that was awful. And I think there was this really horrible scotch egg that we made, which was really disgusting. So there was like some really bad moments in our testing.
Finally, she cracked the coniferous code and found that treating the needles of the tree like an herb was the way to go.
Just like rosemary, right? So you'd use rosemary to cook with, but you wouldn't necessarily eat like a sprig of rosemary.
Georgialis has since whipped up recipes like Christmas tree pickles, white pine sorbet, and a cocktail that requires two large handfuls of spruce, branches included. You can find the recipes in her cookbook, aptly called How to Eat Your Christmas Tree. The concept may seem experimental to some, but Georgialis points out the idea is nothing new.
All this project is really is kind of foraging, you know, you're just kind of eating something that you wouldn't buy in a supermarket, you know, fir and pine and spruce have been cooked with for hundreds and hundreds of years.
In Scandinavia, pine bark is turned into a flour-like substance to add flavor to cookies and breads, while Greek vintners use Aleppo pine sap in their white wine. It's called retsina. And in North America, indigenous cuisine uses evergreen trees in tea, braises, and stews. But before you go running to the kitchen, a warning. Some Christmas trees are poisonous if eaten, including yews and cedars.
You absolutely cannot eat those.
Georgialis also recommends checking to make sure your tree wasn't sprayed with pesticides or other chemicals before you brought it home. If eating your Christmas tree isn't your thing, Georgialis says you can still adopt the sustainable mindset.
It's the idea of just thinking about how you could repurpose things that you wouldn't have otherwise thought about repurposing.
That could mean using parts of the tree for art projects with the kids, wood for your fireplace, or even air fresheners for the car, keeping the holiday spirit around just a little while longer. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
And if you have an artificial tree, do I really need to say it? The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. From all of us here at The World, a happy Thanksgiving to you all. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.